Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 26 for Wednesday, November 7th, 2007. Senator Harrison Schmitt, the last man to walk on the moon. Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audible.com/biotech today for details.
I was strolling on the moon one day in a merry, merry month of December. Now, May, when much to my surprise, a pair of bunny eyes.
Oh, is this a neat way to travel? Isn't it great? I like to skip along. But me, boy. Skip. Skip. Those great voices you just heard are Harrison Jack Schmitt, Lunar Module Pilot, and Gene Cernan, Commander of Apollo 17. They were the two last men to walk on the moon. But to be accurate here, Harrison Schmitt was the last man out of the Lunar Module to set his foot down on the surface. Well, Gene Cernan was the last person to step back into the lunar module just before takeoff in December 1972. So either way, they can both lay claim to being the last man on the moon. It's just a matter of how you look at it. Well, in this episode, we talked to Dr. Schmitt, former senator from New Mexico, who was the first American astronaut scientist. He's a Harvard-trained geologist. I really wanted to invite him on the show, not only because he is, in my opinion, one of the great explorers of our time, but because he's a scientist. He has a unique perspective on the experience and the mission, which included living on the moon for 3 days and exploring its surface in the valley of Torres Litro. I would like to mention that there are a couple of recently released movies which feature Dr. Schmitt and the rest of the Apollo astronauts. The first is the Ron Howard production, In the Shadow of the Moon, which is in theaters around the world, and The Wonder of It All. I provide links to both in the show notes, so you can find them there. Dr. Schmitt is also an author of a book entitled Return to the Moon, Exploration, Enterprise, and Energy in the Human Settlement of Space, forwarded by Neil Armstrong. It's an absolutely great read, though I must admit you probably won't find it on Oprah's list, but I thought it was absolutely fascinating. So, on to the interview. You have a book called Return to the Moon, and in the book you mentioned that Apollo established a new evolutionary status for human beings, and it's what I think is what fascinates me most about the Apollo missions. What did you mean exactly by the new evolutionary status?
Well, we now know that the resources exist on the moon and also on Mars to support the development of human settlements that can ultimately survive independently of the Earth. And once you have begun to become a species of the solar system, you can expect, presumably, expect evolutionary changes, whether they're biological in nature or technological in nature, or both, more likely both. We will just, somebody will have to wait and see. But that's basically what I meant. And Apollo, particularly symbolized by the pictures of the rising Earth taken from behind the moon, which demonstrates a commitment to the gravitational field of another body in the solar system, Apollo really did break through in that context and opportunity, and those ecological niches would be very contrary to basically what species do in nature.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the Apollo missions and then the latter half talk about your how you've what you've been advocating is the use of helium-3 as a resource for energy, one of the energy solutions to our energy problems on Earth. What was it like? So you finished your PhD in geology at Harvard. What was the selection process for Apollo, and how did you get involved?
The process of NASA and deciding that they would select scientist astronauts began well before I really had done any thinking about that possibility. It began back in the within a year after Kennedy made his announcement, pressure was building from the National Academy of Sciences and others for NASA to begin to consider the use of scientists, particularly geologists, in the lunar missions. And Harold Urey, who had a significant amount of influence, the Nobel Prize laureate, who had a significant amount of influence on NASA at the, in those early 60s, also said that the person who was first on the moon should be a hard rock geologist, and that's a direct quote. But it did not materialize, in my view, until about November of 1964, when NASA and the National Academy jointly asked for volunteers, publicly asked for volunteers to join a selection for scientist astronauts. About 1,200 scientists and engineers applied. Initially, that was winnowed down to 400 through basically a FAA, Federal Aviation Administration physical. And then those 400 were evaluated in various stages by the National Academy of Sciences, then appeared for a physical at Brooks Air Force Base, which NASA used among and also interviews to finally select six of the first group of scientist astronauts and the fourth group of astronauts selected overall.
That must have been grueling and nerve-wracking. Did you know you wanted this from the minute you saw the announcement?
Well, from the seconds I saw the announcement, it looked like the right thing to do. I had not thought seriously about being involved directly in manned spaceflight. But I do recall that it, in part of that early precursor activity, the National Academy put out a report in which it said that the first person on the moon should be a hard rock geologist. My fellow grad students and I at Harvard thought that was great and cheered and drank a few beers and and then went about our business of trying to get PhD theses. But at the time the announcement came out, I was already working coincidentally, for Gene Shoemaker at the branch of astrogeology of the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And what was your job there?
I had begun to organize a project funded by NASA that we call Lunar Field Geological Methods. And it was the first effort by anyone, to my knowledge, and still today, to actually start to think seriously about how a space-suited astronaut would conduct field exploration on the moon and collect samples and take photographs and describe what he or she was seeing. And that was the project that Shoemaker asked me to organize. He had already gotten the contract before I got there. And so that's what we did. And so I worked on that for a full year before I then appeared at pilot training in July of 19.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I lost you. So I lost you at the time when you did your pilot training. When did you get your wings? And did you get it? So at that point, when you were doing the work with NASA, you went out and trained to fly.
Well, the scientist astronauts were selected in the spring of 1965, and three of us who did not have any pilot training before were assigned to Williams Air Force Base in Chandler, Arizona, to go through flying school and to learn to fly T-38 jets. We started out actually in Cessna 172s and then spent 90 hours in T-37s and then ultimately 150 hours in T-38s before we then got our wings, and I then reported officially to Houston to continue my astronaut activities.
Wow.
A little bit, in 1967, all of the astronauts, including the pilots, then pilots that were already there, were sent in groups to Navy helicopter training. So everybody in the Apollo astronaut cadre, including scientists, did become qualified helicopter pilots as well.
What do you prefer to fly? What's your favorite plane?
I enjoyed both of them. The helicopters were just really, really interesting to fly. They were very challenging. We were actually flying the MASH-style helicopter, the Bell H-13, which did not have any automatic systems in it at all. You were flying it continuously with feet and hands. And so it was exciting and really a lot of fun to fly and very good training for hand-eye coordination.
So you're a scientist among military men. How did that play out? Did you feel, were they really nice guys to work with, or was it extremely competitive? What was that like?
I think for some of the scientist astronauts, it was a little bit awkward. But for me, since I was the only geologist, I think that things went better for me because I was bringing something to the table that was going to be important to those that were going to be assigned to flights early on. I don't think that they really perceived that I would be a threat to their crew slots because Deke Slayton, our senior boss at the time, I think had made it very clear to commanders that they would select their crews, and it wasn't obvious that any commander wanted to select a scientist, even though he had been trained as a pilot, to his crew. I mean, he had many other personal commitments to other people. And really, my final assignment, my first assignment as a backup crewman to the Apollo 15 mission with Dick Gordon and Vance Brann, was pretty much dictated by headquarters. And that would have put me in a normal sequence, not always held to, but a normal sequence of flying in a prime crew on Apollo 18. Well, it wasn't very long after that assignment was made to the backup crew of Apollo 15 that everyone finally figured out that there was not going to be Apollo 18. And so then it became a question of was anyone at headquarters going to force the selection of me? And I was the only one really in the game at the time, only one scientist. Were they going to force my selection to the Apollo 17 crew, in which indeed finally they did.
You knew at this time that this would be the last mission to the moon?
Oh, yes. That became very clear to the astronauts and to all of us during the training for Apollo 15, probably in late 1970, early 1971. The decisions that led to that being the last mission were really made several years before in the budgets and other things and attitudes that were developing within NASA, and presumably also political attitudes that were developing within the Nixon administration and indeed the Congress as well. Nixon often gets the blame for or his administration for terminating the Apollo program, but that the Congress has a lot to say in that. Relative to budgets, and they were complicit in that termination as well. And NASA had decided they did not want to continue to use the Apollo systems. They wanted to go off and build something new, namely a space shuttle. I think that was historically a very, very bad decision. It's increasingly clear, I think, to everybody, including the current administrator of NASA, Michael Griffin, that we never should have abandoned the Apollo Saturn technologies. But we did, and you live with those kind of decisions and press on.
Well, it's almost to at a point where space exploration right now has really split off into unmanned missions and of small and low cost, but the impact on humanity and the way it inspires the rest of humanity is certainly not what Apollo did. Apollo was absolutely pulled everyone together in an incredible unity.
I think the balance in the program is in a gross sense is quite good. The so-called unmanned robotic missions are not small and low cost. They do result in extraordinary new information in environments that are not yet accessible to us or would never be accessible to human beings, at least not in the foreseeable future. And so I'm a great supporter of those missions, and I think human spaceflight will increasingly work hand in hand with robotic assistance of various kinds, although it's never quite clear, and not yet quite clear, how that hand in hand cooperation really can be implemented. But I think it will. Smart people will figure that out. Right now, the NASA science budget that's identified under the Science Mission Directorate of NASA is a third of the total NASA budget. It has never been higher than that. Within that science budget, there have been some problems, so we haven't got nearly the bang for the buck that one would think that we could. And the current director of the Science Mission Directorate, Alan Stern, is trying very, very hard, and I think he's a very bright young man, and I think will probably be reasonably successful to get more bang for the buck. But for example, the James Webb Telescope, which, if it is ultimately completed and flown, is going to be a magnificent astronomical observatory, was originally forecast to cost $1.5 billion, and its current price tag is probably about $4.5 billion. So you can see how much that ate into the science budget.
Wow. We interviewed Deborah Bass last week, who's at the JPL, and she's the deputy scientist for the Phoenix Mars mission. And of course, the science going on in the Phoenix Mars mission is brilliant. And I suppose before we land a man on the Mars, we'd best get really good at flying there and proceeding with robotic missions.
Well, the robotic missions are important for characterizing the Martian environment. And however, they do not relate directly to whether a manned mission to Mars, human mission to Mars, will be successful. The primary unknowns for going to Mars with human beings relate to issues that are not yet being addressed fully by the robotic program. The first issue is how biomedically, how are human beings going to be protected for long duration flights between the Earth and Mars, during which they would be exposed not only to the steady low level of galactic radiation, but to potential of occasional solar particle events or coronal mass ejections that can be extraordinarily damaging, if not deadly. So that's number one. Now, there's, by the way, all of these things I'm sure we have solutions for. Protection against radiation is reasonably straightforward, as many of your listeners know, in that you just need a lot of water or hydrogen or some low mass material between around you to protect you. And excuse me. Now, but the real long pole in the tent right now technologically is learning how to put very large payloads on the surface of Mars. It is estimated that about the largest payload we now know how to do and can develop hardware that we can test to put on the surface of Mars is about 4 metric tons. If you get up to the size that human flight is going to require, say on the order of 40 metric tons, you're going to have to do things we don't know how to do yet in terms of entry, descent, and landing. For example, parachutes are used to slow the vehicles down once you get into this very thin Martian atmosphere. But for a 40 metric ton vehicle, you would have to have a parachute the size of the Rose Bowl in California.
Wow.
and even though we can imagine how you would build such a parachute, how do you test it? Other than maybe by flights in Earth orbit at the comparable atmospheric pressures and velocities that you would you presumably could develop. So there's a lot we don't know about entry, descent, and landing on Mars. Yeah, you're going to have to come to some very new operational decisions. The Earth is not going to be a significant player in a Mars mission. Communication delays make that inevitable. So you have to learn how to operate. The crews have to learn how to operate autonomously in the vicinity of Mars. You also almost certainly will have the philosophy that you'll not abort and leave Mars if you start to have a problem during landing. The philosophy will be to develop systems that allow you to abort to landing, and then you work out what the problems might be and how then you you use your ascent stage to get back home if that indeed is called for. So I'm just mentioning all these things to say that we're a long way from understanding how to land on Mars. And one of the great advantages of having the moon around is that many of these operational techniques can be simulated or are practiced in the vicinity of the moon with many fewer consequences than they would be if you tried to do it for the first time on a real mission to Mars.
Having a human do the experiment rather than having a robot doing some data analysis, is it better to have – what can a human bring that that can't be done with robotics and remote control or advanced systems?
At the present time, and I think in the foreseeable future, human trained, experienced human beings bring the following. Number one, they bring a qualitative supercomputer that has yet to be duplicated in any significant way, namely the brain. And that brain can be instantaneously reprogrammed based on experience and training to take advantage of or to react to new situations. With that brain are tied a magnificent optical system, namely the human eye, our eyes, that provide a dynamic range in excess of that is generally found possible with hardware systems and electronic systems. And also tied to that brain are the human hands, which are a remarkably dexterous manipulation system. So you put those three things together, if they're properly assisted by pressure suits and other systems, and you have something that is well beyond what robotics can do when faced with new conditions, with new environments in which you want to explore. And I don't see humans being out of the equation for the foreseeable future. And of course, there I have not mentioned the psychological need that I think human beings feel in order to be there themselves. Being there is the essential human ingredient in all future space exploration and settlement. And I don't expect that to change much either.
Well, definitely the astronauts on the Apollo mission and yourself included are truly some of the most important explorers that humanity has seen. I would like to take a minute to thank Audible.com for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. If you're in the U.S. or in Canada, I think, you can download a free audiobook from over 35,000 titles by going to audible.com/biotech. This week, my pick is Einstein, His Life and Universe by Walter Isaacson. It's a book based on the newly released personal letters of Albert Einstein. Isaacson really explores how Einstein went from being a patent clerk, unable to get a teaching job or doctorate, to becoming the locksmith into the mysteries of the atom and the universe. He really provides insights into Einstein's thought processes. And let me tell you, if you're around today, I'd certainly try to get him on the podcast. But he's not, so I guess this is as close as it gets. So if you'd like to download Einstein, His Life, and Universe by Walter Isaacson, or any other audiobook, go to audible.com/biotech. You sign up, and you'll get a free audiobook download. You'll also get discounts on future audiobooks. If you want, though, you can simply cancel within 14 days and there'll be no charge, but you get to keep the book. That said, back to our conversation, Dr. Harrison Schmidt. As you could tell, I'm very thrilled to be speaking with you. I'm very touched that you accepted to do the interview.
My pleasure.
So I've got a couple of questions about your mission and your work as a geologist on the moon. It was 3 days to the moon, 4 days to the moon, 3 days there, and 3 days back.
It was basically three and a half days to the moon. We spent most of a day in orbit getting positioned properly for a landing. We spent 3 days on the surface of the moon. And then after joining up with the other spacecraft, we spent another 2 days, maybe day and a half, in lunar orbit, operating a variety of remote sensing experiments, including my eyes, and then 3 days coming back. So, as I recall, the total mission time was 301 hours.
That was the longest Apollo mission, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
And you spent the longest amount of time on the moon. Especially yes. in extravehicular activity.
We had a lot of Guinness records of that kind. Longest this, longest that, most return samples. And we were really quite proud to have that opportunity.
A lot of the historical pictures from the Apollo missions that we see out there, some of the most beautiful pictures are the pictures that you took.
I am blushing.
And so were you the person who took the blue marble picture?
Yes, I took that from about 34,000 miles from the Earth.
Was it as awe-inspiring as it was? I mean, does the picture really translate that awe of watching the Earth draw in the distance?
Or what I was seeing? No, and it really can't, because there's no way to project that picture or to print that picture and not still have some light in the background. You may be able, with digital reproductions, you may be able to come pretty close to reproducing what I saw or what we saw relative to the Earth itself, although I haven't seen that done yet. But there's always going to be, in any kind of a print or reproduction, there's going to be some light in the background of space, and that has to be, to really get the right feeling for what you're seeing, absolutely black. unless you can imagine that, you don't really get a good feeling for what we saw. Now, I will give Michael Light credit, who in his book Full Moon, for having come as close as anybody to printing a black background, but still there's some light there.
What was going through your mind when you were watching that, with the Earth become further and further? Did you worry that you might not come back?
No, I had no worries about that. I mean, if you were worried about that, you shouldn't have been on the mission. I'd always had an interest in meteorology, based on my father having an interest, and we worked together on that when I was growing up in Silver City, New Mexico. So when I knew that I was going to the moon, I began to discuss with the Air Force meteorologist down at the Kennedy Space Center how I could primarily launch with the latest satellite weather pictures that were available. And then I used those as a takeoff point in order to spend the most of 3 days, the time I had that wasn't required for flight operational activities, observing the weather, shifting weather patterns of the Earth. And that was a fascinating experience. It kept me not only occupied, but intellectually very much stimulated to try to be a weather forecaster in space, because as you recognize, by the time we were headed towards the moon, we were in what was called a lunar reference trajectory. And so the Earth was rotating once every 24 hours in space as we observed it. And that gave me a chance to say, all right, the weather in New Zealand is probably going to do this tomorrow. And then I got a chance to check it out the next day. I filled up hundreds of pages of transcript talking about the Earth weather, and I was quite privileged when Robert White, the then director of NOAA after our mission, in conjunction with the Public Service Award, gave me an official NOAA rain gauge. And my mother, because I was not living in Silver City at the time. My mother then took that and became sort of a quasi-official recorder of rainfall in the Silver City area.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience on the moon. Were you prepared for the experience of living for 3 days outside the Earth? What was it like camping? I'm sorry.
I felt fully prepared. Not really like camping, but to some degree that might be an analogy. You're of course taking very, very close observation of your equipment and making sure that everything is functioning well. You have a lot more things that have to work in a spacecraft to live on the moon than you would in a tent living here on Earth. I felt that that part of the technical side of the mission was well prepared for. We were well trained. We knew how to do our part of it. And also a lot of confidence that if we, for example, in the very remote possibility of losing communications with the Earth, that we could come back home. We knew how to do that. Now, I think the thing that was that you can't train for, and that you just have to be there to assimilate, is being outside the spacecraft, finally being able to see this magnificent deep valley that we landed in, the Valley of Taurus Littrow, a valley with mountains on either side, 6,000 and 7,000 feet high. Valley was illuminated by a brilliant sun all the time we were there, but the mountains themselves were placed against this blacker than black sky, which is very hard to get used to, believe me. You're used in a bright sunshiny day in New Mexico of seeing a brilliant blue sky. Well, and on the moon, it's black.
And you don't see stars, do you?
Your eye has a very good dynamic range, but just like here on Earth during a sunny day, you cannot see stars. You can see them at night if you dark adapt, but you can't see them during the day. One way to see stars on Earth is to go during the day is to get into a deep well or to use a collimated tube. You can search out stars that way. But we did that on the moon. We actually had what we called a one-power telescope that allowed us to find stars for aligning our navigational system. But that is very hard to get used to. I never got used to seeing a black sky with a brilliant sun.
When you were as a geologist, you must have thought, "Wow, I actually have the opportunity now to do work that no geologist has ever done, and to really explore the environment, and it's an absolutely extreme environment." How did that go about? How did you pick samples? What did you find the most interesting when you landed? And then what was the game plan for studying the moon and its history and its resources?
The Apollo 17 mission site was selected because it looked like it was a place and turned out to be a place where a wide variety of materials could be examined by what presumably was an experienced field geologist. And that the materials there would help us refine our already growing understanding, first-order understanding of the origin and evolution of the moon based on the returns from other missions. We had a traverse plan for each day. We pretty much carried out the plan. The plan was based on photographs that had been taken by previous missions, particularly the Apollo 15 mission, but the resolution of those photographs was still not down at the level where you could look at individual samples, of course. And so at each of the stations we had selected that probably would be of interest, we were pretty much on our own. I mean, that we had lots of time built into the schedule for me to try to examine the local area, to decide what might be the best detailed exploration plan, what items would be of most interest, and then Gene Cernan and I would set about executing that real-time plan that I would envision for a particular site, in addition to doing a few things and collecting a few specialized samples that we had planned to do before we left the Earth. Probably, and at every site, there was something unexpected, something new, of varying importance. So far, one never knows how samples will suddenly become important over the long term as ideas change and new techniques for analytical work are available. Your listeners have probably experienced that in many different ways in their own fields. But in our case, probably the most important sample that we found was on our second excursion at the crater Shorty, the so-called orange glass, sometimes called the orange soil. It made up of very tiny beads and averaged about 40 microns in diameter of orange volcanic glass formed during a fire fountain of a volcanic fire fountain some 3.5 billion years ago. And the most interesting aspect of this glass is that the volatiles that were projecting this material up above the surface to cool and then fall back as little tiny beads appear to have come from very deep within the interior of the moon. And they established some very clear constraints on how the moon might have formed as a coherent body and also what the composition of the interior of the moon might be.
Was the moon the result of a Mars-sized collision or planet that collided with Earth, or was it a dual planetary system?
In my estimation, probably not the result of a giant impact by a Mars-sized object on a young Earth. And that, when you really look at that hypothesis closely, it's really an impact-assisted capture. Because everybody agrees now that the moon mostly has to be made up of what was on the impacting Mars-sized asteroid, and very, very little, if any, of the material has come from the Earth's mantle. It's just the geochemical constraints are too restrictive for that to happen. However, if you have an impact-assisted capture, the essentially all of the what becomes the moon ultimately becomes the moon has to rise to thousands of degrees because of the transfer of kinetic energy into heat energy, and the orange soil and a companion soil sample found at the Apollo 15 site called the green soil both have characteristics that are incompatible, as far as we know right now, are incompatible with the kind of temperatures that would result from a giant impact.
What are your thoughts on helium-3? You're recognized as being an advocate for helium-3 for fusion reactions. Is this the way to get back to the moon?
Well, it's obviously we're going to try to get back to the moon via government, a national policy, and with NASA implementing that policy. And I think that's clearly can be done. If the funding levels are adequate to not only minimize risk, but actually move the technologies forward at a reasonable pace. Now, the alternative that I suggested some years ago was that if you can come up with a means of interesting private investors in the technologies as well as the reality of helium-3 fusion using lunar helium-3, then I think you could do it through largely a private sector initiative as well. Helium-3, a light isotope of helium, is not an abundant isotope in absolute terms on the moon. There's probably 20 parts per million, for example, 20 parts per billion with a B in the soil samples that Neil Armstrong brought back. It had up to coal, today's coal, 100 kilograms of that helium-3 would have a fuel value, an energy equivalent value, of about $140 million. And so when you look at that, it starts to attract your interest economically, and particularly since the technologies, potential technologies that could use helium-3 in fusion reactors on a commercial basis are much less capital intensive than those that have been proposed for other types of energy sources. And the characteristics of helium-3 fusion means that you have the potential of no radioactive isotopes being produced as part of the reaction. It's not radioactive in itself. and that you can convert directly to electricity. The protons that are produced by that fusion process can be converted directly to electricity rather than having to go through some kind of a heat cycle, which cuts your efficiency in half. My colleagues at the University of Wisconsin, Madison and I, have been very interested in pursuing whether or not this particular concept is going to make sense this century as one of the many options we're going to have to exercise in order to find alternatives, long-term alternatives to fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are still our ace in the hole. They're going to provide energy to the world for a long time. But at some point, I think it's only prudent that we begin to exercise a variety of other options, including nuclear fission, which we use today. 20% of power in the United States is produced by nuclear fission. 80% plus is produced in France. So it's an important option. And on a regional basis, I suspect solar energy in its various forms and derivatives will also play a role. But still, when you look at the growing Earth population, at the growing aspirations of that population to have standards of living close to or comparable to that of the United States and Europe and other developed countries, you know darn good and well we're going to need a lot more energy than what we can imagine right now we're going to have. And I think lunar helium-3 fusion will play an important part in that role as the century progresses.
Well, I certainly think that it will. The time will come when it will be, you know, used. It's phenomenal. It would be a green form of nuclear power.
It really is, and nuclear power is pretty green just to begin with. But helium-3 fusion makes it even more green, and that's the story I try to tell in the book that I published last year called Return to the Moon.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes so that people can go to it. I bought the book last week, and I've been bouncing from chapter to chapter in a complete disarray because...
Well, that's all right. Every chapter should stand somewhat by itself.
It does, and that's what was fun about it. And as I'd be finishing one chapter, it led me to a question that was on five chapters down and then back and forth, and it was absolutely a fun read. And the reality of it... coming from someone who's been there and has done it is a strong, the strongest possible voice for helium-3 to think that, you know, if he can do it, you know, almost 40 years ago, I think we can get a rocket up there and pull back 100 kilos of helium-3. And you've got an incredible level of detail on how to go about doing that. And I was very impressed also with your, the chapters on organization and management and how to get through that and the economics of it. It must have been.
Well, it's all that I tried to cover every major aspect that a business or a government agency like NASA would have to cover in order to go back to the moon, and that includes space law, it includes business, it includes. I think you need to know the history of how it was done before. It has some of that in it. You have to understand your resource base and so forth. One of the things that your particular audience, I think, would be interested in is that the first business opportunity for helium-3 technology, not helium-3 fusion technology, not power technology, but for the technology to produce small amounts of power through helium-3 is in producing positron-emitting isotopes for PET diagnostic systems, and to be producing them at point of use rather than in large cyclotrons. And I think that ultimately will be a major breakthrough in the much broader application of PET diagnostic medical technologies than we have today.
And definitely the first step to allow us to do some of the R&D to move helium-3 technologies forward.
Yeah, there are many several potential businesses on the path as you move up to higher and higher power levels towards break even in the fusion process. So we're quite optimistic that there are many opportunities for investors along the way. before you ever have to make that final decision, well, are we going to take it to the moon?
How about this for a final question? What did you find more challenging, the Apollo mission or being a senator?
I don't think you can compare them. Apollo training and preparing to go on an Apollo mission took an extraordinary amount of technical concentration of learning and technical subjects and practice and more practice in order to make sure that you were prepared for essentially any eventuality. In the Senate, you're dealing more with personalities, with political issues, with less technical issues, and the experience was far less productive on a day-to-day basis than what I experienced as an astronaut. It was still intellectually very challenging. I'm more than glad that I did it. I had planned to do it from the time I was a graduate student, do something like that from the time I was a graduate student at Harvard. And I don't regret a bit of it. I do miss the information flow that comes with being a United States Senator. I am very disappointed in the inability of the Congress, which was apparent even when I was there, but it's gotten worse. But to deal with issues of the future in a comprehensive and intelligent, common sense way, I don't know what we do about that. I know what I would do about it. I would limit the term of continuous service for senators and congressmen, so more and more people can get involved in the political process, and more people who have training other than the law. It's important to have lawyers in your political establishment, no question about it. But on the other hand, it's also important to have people who know how to solve problems. Lawyers are basically trained to treat the symptoms of problems and not to find solutions.
Well, that's, I suppose, where your training brought a lot of extra, gave you some extra abilities that were rare in Washington, D.C.
Well, I certainly was clairvoyant. There's no question about that.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on. I'm going to put the links to your book, Return to the Moon, and I will also mention the movie that's coming out this month. It came out last Friday here in Connecticut, In the Shadow
there
of the
actually,
Moon.
Mark, there's actually two movies that are coming out almost simultaneously. One's getting a lot more publicity than the other, but I think they're both equally worth seeing. The other one's called The Wonder of It All. And the film producer there is one Jeffrey Roth. And you might, I suspect, you can Google that and find a link to it.
Sure.
I suspect. And also, you might want to link to the NASA Advisory Council site, which you can get through the NASA website, because it's there where many of the current discussions of that council take place, and I chair that council. So it's another way to try to keep up on what at least the advisors to the administrator are thinking about various things related to current space and aeronautics activities.
Will do. I will also, with your permission, at the Fusion Technology Institute, there's some class notes from the course called Resources from Space. And
that's a good source of stuff. And particularly the last one we have taught so far was 2004. That's the one people should look for.
The PDFs are available for the show notes, or the class notes, sorry.
And they go all the way back to 96. And there's different stuff in each one. And I think in the first set of course notes, there's a description of what it was like on the moon, a fairly lengthy description with pictures. So people maybe get a kick out of that one.
It was a lot of fun researching this interview. Also, you wrote a fantastic piece called A Field Trip to the Moon. That is from the course, Fall 1996.
That's right. That's
it was fun how you describe your colleagues in Ron Evans's, eating all the chocolate. That's absolutely great. I'll let people read it. It's a great story.
I'm going to have to run here. I've got a get to the airport.
Thank you, and I really, really appreciate it.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right. Bye.
I would like to thank Senator Harrison Schmidt for being on the show today. This one definitely goes down as being one of my favorite interviews. I'd also like to thank him and Gene Cernan for providing the opening theme to this week's episode. And I'd also like to thank Will Hall for the closing theme. I must mention also that Futures in Biotech is also supported by listeners, which is also greatly appreciated. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.